the investment that's being made in these ideas and this code and in getting high-level crypto systems out to the world, it's the kind of thing you can't easily put back in the bag. So from my perspective, all the work that's done in the space is freedom enhancing in the long term.
Hello, welcome to episode 37 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. Everyone has a unique story. When I started this podcast, I really wanted to talk to Bitcoiners who hadn't been exposed yet in the Bitcoin media. There were a couple of really interesting local Bitcoin traders I wanted to interview, but surprisingly, it's sometimes easier to get on a Bitcoin core developer than to get on a lot of lesser known people who still have very Bitcoin-centric lives. One person I met at my first Bitcoin meetup was Christopher Camp. And now, over 3 years later, I finally got to sit down with Chris and find out a bit more about him and his interest in Bitcoin. Note this was recorded a few weeks ago, before the halving, and when the price of Bitcoin was just a bit under the 52-week high. Christopher Camp, you look so different than when I first met you at a Bitcoin meetup in LA. It was like, I guess, the first big Bitcoin meetup downtown LA in May, June 2013.
May sounds right. Yeah, somewhere around then.
You had a lot of hair and a full beard, I think.
That's true. I had a giant beard, sort of the cryptographer, mathematician style. Although that's not my area. Maybe just sort of aspiring.
And your look is so different. I was like, no, I don't know this guy. Who's this guy?
And I forget that I look so different. So.
At that first meetup, I talked to a lot of people. Stephen Gornick was there, mm-hmm. Pinguino, Joseph M. Perling.
And Josh.
Oh, Josh, right.
And for me, it was really just getting into the Bitcoin scene in person and starting to dive deeper into Bitcoin. You know, I'd heard about it when it first came out on Slashdot, which was maybe beginning of 2011, somewhere around then, and had been interested in crypto stuff for a long time, digital money especially, but just had the sense that this was a problem that wasn't going to be solved anytime soon and that Bitcoin wasn't solving it. I didn't dive deeply into it, and I had sort of become a cynic on digital money schemes or ideas. And so when it came up on Slashdot, I didn't dig into it. And then it wasn't until later 2012, early 2013, that it started getting on my radar again. And I moved from the Bay Area to Los Angeles, and it seemed like a good way to both learn more about Bitcoin and start meeting people in a new area.
What was your background before that?
When I started college, I was interested in technology, and my roommate had a computer, got it hooked up to the internet, and the version of the internet then was all command line kind of interface. It's FTP and Gopher, so you could go check to see if the library had a book in stock. You could send emails to people. There was also Usenet, so sort of early stage forums. At that time, I started getting interested in crypto, libertarian, that whole dynamic. And it was maybe, I don't know, a year later that the first graphical browser came out, Mosaic was released, and you know, just sparked this huge, huge amount of interest in me. And the people that were also online at that time were, not surprisingly, geeks and early adopters who were members of the cypherpunk scene and crypto anarchists and that whole world. And so I gravitated towards that stuff and was reading a lot about it, and also got drawn into transhumanism and, you know, all these sort of things about envisioning what the world would look like in the future.
What's transhumanism?
Transhumanism is this idea that we're not at the end stage of biological evolution, so that there will be, just like things came before humans, that, you know, after there will continue to be evolution beyond humans, basically. So, and it's a group that sort of advocates investigating that phenomenon, taking some control over how we evolve.
Is there any consideration of us exterminating ourselves and that not happening?
Oh, yeah.
Is that an issue you guys focus on, or is that just kind of auxiliary to what your focus is?
I think it depends on who you're talking to within the community, although the people that I respect spend a lot of time thinking about what are called extinction scenarios or existential risks, so things that could destroy all life on this planet or all human life or do a dramatic setback in terms of progress in general. And so Nick Bostrom in particular is someone who's written a lot about this stuff. I think it's really interesting, especially in an age where you have decreasing cost curves for all kinds of technology. It's like memory in your computer or processing power, but also, you know, other technologies may be subject to those same forces, like weapons and even weapons of mass destruction. So, you know, if you look at the end of where that curve ends up, you could get to a place where, you know, weapons of mass destruction are ubiquitous. So what I like thinking about is the social systems we need to navigate those kind of possibilities.
Is that a good lead-in for Restart Democracy?
Yeah, Restart Democracy is directly related to that idea of trying to build new systems for social decision-making that allow us to manage ourselves and our society in consideration of all these new powers that we're creating. I founded Restart after I graduated from law school, and it was my primary focus for about a year. I took a semester off from law school and worked with Lawrence Lessig on campaign finance reform and his ideas to get money out of politics, that it has this corrupting influence on every aspect of political decision making, and it's an important part of what humans do and where we're going in general, like over a course of a year, 10 years, 100 years. And so fixing that political problem became something that I started really focusing on, and came up with a different approach, which was instead of trying to get money out of politics, which felt like you're asking the political system to fix itself, and it's a broken system, so there's a flaw there, that maybe a better idea is to tap into the will of the people. So basically create a new voting system that would operate on the internet. And over time, the idea evolved to be sort of like Bitcoin, in the sense that it would be a parallel system. You wouldn't go to the government and ask them to replace the dollar with Bitcoin. You just create Bitcoin, and then people start adopting it, and you don't have to wait for approval. And so I think that to the extent we get a new voting system that matters, it will be a parallel system, kind of like Bitcoin is. You start at the edges, and you can do all kinds of things with voting that aren't voting in a public political election. You can create voting systems that enable you to vote on anything that you want to, and included in that is public elections. And by doing that, you start creating trust and engagement in the system. So it's not just something you turn on once every 4 years or every 2 years. It's something that people are kind of engaged with on a daily basis, hopefully, or more often than you are with the standard election system. It's a much more robust polling mechanism than what we have today. And over time, as that poll becomes more and more comprehensive, it encompasses a larger and larger percentage of the electorate, then you have something that's harder and harder for politicians to ignore.
And so Restart Democracy, was this basically the focus of it, trying to achieve this?
That was the focus of it, although that project is now essentially asleep. Once my attention turned to Bitcoin, I got more interested in that, and then I started working for Bitcoin companies. At that point, I switched off of the voting track and really dove fully into Bitcoin and put all my attention there. And then in the last, I'd say 3 to 6 months, I've sort of become interested in the idea of voting again and a communication system that could support that, and also build in some of the ideas that Bitcoin has.
I still remember pretty distinctly when I did meet you at that first meetup. I think I'd asked you what got you into Bitcoin, and yeah. I believe your answer at the time was that you wanted to donate to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, so that was definitely a part of my interest. And one of the points that brought Bitcoin up on my radar again, I had been on the WikiLeaks mailing list, although I wasn't an active participant in any way when that was first getting started, and loved the idea of having whistleblower systems like that, and was supportive of the idea in general, although didn't financially support it or support it with work in any way. But when they got cut off from all sources of financing except for Bitcoin, that sparked this idea that, oh, maybe this is real. Maybe the reason that it can continue to function even in a politically adverse environment is because it's doing what it should do. And so that rekindled my interest in digital money again. Although I still, even at that point, you know, I was focused on other stuff and didn't dive deep into Bitcoin.
Today's magic word is experience. E-X-P-E-R-I-E-N-C-E. Enter the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB Coin listener reward on letstalkbitcoin.com. Support the show by buying a Bitcoin keychain at bkeychain.com. This is the classic Bitcoin keychain you've seen all over the internet. It's a substantial coin-like medallion that you'll be proud to keep with you at all times. Again, that's bkeychain.com. So I'm not sure if I'm clear. You said you went to law school. You mentioned, cryptographer aspirations or something. What are your skills?
Sure. So undergrad in economics, and then I worked at a law firm after that in their risk management department, and then went to law school. And going to law school was a transition point in the sense that I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do career-wise, long-term. Had these different interests in technology, politics, and law. And so felt like a good way to go back to school and kind of figure out, okay, what do you want to do? An expensive way to do that, but still ended up being something I think was worth doing. So went to law school. I did a couple things in law school, like work with Lawrence Lessig on his project, and also worked for a group called the Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics, which is a think tank and research group focused on basically ensuring that you can think and do what you want with your own thoughts and brain, so that from a technology perspective, it's a more future-looking, and making sure that you have control over your own body and brain. And then from a current perspective, it's pretty much focused on drug law and things like that. And so that's another area why Bitcoin is interesting to me, is sort of its ability to give people higher levels of freedom.
What is the envisioned technological interplay with having control of your mind and body?
There's things like brain-controlled interfaces, so that you can do right now. Like, some people have this condition where they're essentially locked in. They don't have an ability to communicate, or maybe you're just paralyzed. And so you can control a cursor with your brain right now. It's early stage technology, but the idea longer term is that the way technology has been advancing, if it continues to do that, then you get to a place where maybe you have your brain in a cloud or something, and starting to think through what that world looks like, what kind of rights you want to protect, some of the same rights that we have now. And there's questions about, well, is it correct to have the same right to privacy if your brain is in a cloud? Is that something that's useful or not? So those are the kinds of issues that they explored. And
wow, that's pretty far out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, and you were transitioning to say this all got you kind of...
Yeah, so it's kind of this mix of different things that drew me into Bitcoin, and I've ended up working in that for Coinbase for a little bit, initially just on their remote support team, which was really a way for me to learn more about Bitcoin and find a way to participate in the community, because I'm still working full-time at a law firm doing risk management. And so working part-time with Coinbase was the perfect match in terms of giving me an opportunity to spend time figuring out what's going on with Bitcoin exactly. It was fun.
So is that like email support or?
Exactly. Where are my Bitcoin? What is Bitcoin? What's this address? Why haven't these Bitcoin reached my other wallet, you know?
So when did you start working for them?
That was January 2014.
How big did they seem at that point, you know, from an internal perspective?
Yeah, they were definitely a giant in the space, but nowhere near what they are now. They were still growing rapidly, and I think their support team was maybe, this is a guess, but it's ballpark correct, I think 15, 20 people in different time zones scattered all over the world. And at that point, it was not that easy to find people who knew about Bitcoin and who could do the support tasks that they needed. So wherever they were was fine.
Any fun stories or just interesting lessons you gained out of interfacing with so many people that you're allowed to tell?
Nothing great, although a few sad stories as Mt. Gox fell apart. You know, people had a good number of coins on there, and just to watch that money evaporate was seeing it happen right in front of you to someone that you worked with, lose a sizable amount of money. I think goes back to one of the great attributes of Bitcoin, which is controlling your own coins.
And I'm curious, do you think they were, you know, actively trading or just using it as a wallet?
I think using it as a wallet, which was not uncommon at that time. And there were at least two things going on. One is that just the convenience factor made it so that people were like, okay, I know I should do this and eventually I will, but next week. And so the value of really actually doing that stuff and making sure you have control over your assets is important. And number two, there started to be a time where people saw the writing on the wall and wanted to take their money out of Mt. Gox, but Mt. Gox wouldn't let them take it out.
I was fortunate, I guess, just listening to Let's Talk Bitcoin. So I remember Andreas saying, you know, kind of, I wouldn't keep my coins there. And I was like, oh, and I was out of Gox a long time before it got difficult, I guess.
Andreas, fortunately, he's just one of the lights in the Bitcoin community that is spreading the good word about controlling your own coins and so many other things. And Andreas did a meetup in Los Angeles, and I talked to him after that. And he, at that point, had transitioned to being chief security officer at Blockchain. I talked to him, and then it turned into a position at Blockchain. So it was really a job where there wasn't a job description, and it was a time where if you're a competent person and know about Bitcoin, then welcome aboard.
That doesn't sound too tough.
I think also there was an element of persistence on my end of really wanting to work for this company, and I had a lot of communication with Andreas and Nick and convinced them to take me on board.
So what'd you do?
So it was a mix of everything. At that point, there was, I don't know, 12 or 14 people on the team, and there was a lot of growth happening. And so I did a little bit of everything, from travel stuff to support tickets to managing the ad platform, which became the core thing that I did.
What's their ad platform?
So they have ads on the site.
Never even noticed.
Yeah. And so we have them inside the wallet and banner ads on the homepage and search results pages. And so I work with other companies in the Bitcoin space, primarily selling ads to them.
So what all are like their properties? I mean, Zero Block is, right?
Yeah.
What else is blockchain that's not identified as blockchain?
I think it's pretty much all blockchain now.
Yeah. You have to say .info, basically, or?
I think.
What's their official name?
We're Blockchain Luxembourg is like the head company. That's where we're headquartered. It's probably better just for avoiding ambiguity to call it blockchain.info.
Boy, who knew that name was going to be such a good, popular name in the coming years?
Jeez. No, it's so true. I think a little bit of luck and a little bit of foresight probably combined. And definitely the blockchain hype cycle is, I don't know if it's near peak, but it's pretty big right now. You see the investment that's being made in these ideas and this code and in getting high-level crypto systems out to the world. It's the kind of thing you can't easily put back in the bag. So from my perspective, all the work that's done in the space is freedom enhancing in the long term. And whether maybe there's a short period of time where private blockchains are in ascendancy or some other technology that's not quite as ideal as Bitcoin, it feels like over time, you're going to have people do things like Zero Cash and all kinds of other undreamt of possibilities that will regain and add to any lost freedom. This space of communication technology, which I think payments are part of that, that's like the core of what humans do. So there is so much. This playground is huge. There's space for all kinds of different implementations and just a huge diversity in range of products and services that can be offered and be successful and find enough users to make them work. So
Bitcoin, last I checked, was around 750 today. We haven't gotten to see this kind of a crazy growth for a while. I don't even know what I think about it. I'm ready for it to just go back down tomorrow every second.
Bitcoin has gone all over the place. And if you let your emotions onto the roller coaster, there was going to be a lot of days with tears and, you know, some days where you're pretty happy, but most of the last 2 years were tears. And so it definitely is nice in a lot of ways to have the price go back up again. For reasons like Professor Bitcoin and all the naysayers, there's something nice about being able to have the price be high again.
Are you using your legal background at all at blockchain?
I do some contract review and different things for them there and maybe transitioning into doing more of that.
What's your like day-to-day schedule like working for them?
Yeah, it's a mix of focus on ads and direct sales, and then also improving our ad platform. That's been a long project of working on moving from a pretty basic system to having something that's much more full-featured. The company has been, and this isn't just with respect to ads, but has been very cautious about what it does and always having the highest priority be on securing user funds and user privacy as well. And so a lot of the things that we've done as a company are focused around those two goals, and ad revenue is long down the list in terms of priorities. But within staying true to those two main goals, we do want to do a better job of delivering value to the ad partners and to the users as well.
How does blockchain either make money now, or what's the goal for being profitable?
The goal longer term is to do integrations that add value to the users. And I think it's really an experiment of figuring out what those things are. Right now, and this is true of most companies in the internet space, is that the idea is to be really great at your core service and get users on board and make them happy. And I think that's been our primary focus from day one, really, when Ben started the company. And the adoption that happened with blockchain was pretty dramatic, and the market really said that they loved this product. We're still seeing strong growth, and our focus is on making a truly great product that's easy to use and that people love to use and will share with their friends, and makes Bitcoin something that people, even if they don't come to it with political motivations or speculative motivations, they just want a way to send money to a family member or whatever it may be, that they can tap into it and make sense of it. And it's as easy as sending a text kind of thing. that's the core focus. And over the longer term, you know, obviously you need to figure out how to turn it into a business too. And it's still an open question, I think, exactly how that happens. I really respect the way the company is run. It's very conservatively run financially, and that gives us a decent runway to, you know, continue building what we think is the biggest customer base in Bitcoin.
And I always make this assumption that pretty much all the companies in this space, they're just looking to the future. Like, no one's trying to make money today, I'd assume, right?
My guess is that, like, in 2014, some of the companies were spending more aggressively because they thought that a transition to mainstream might happen earlier. But I don't have real inside information on that. That's just my sense. But I think that now it's exactly what you said, which is the timing of going mainstream is really hard to predict. So you want to get your core product great, and you want to be ready for when people want to start using your product.
So why should someone use a blockchain wallet?
Yeah, I think especially with the transition to HD, it's a full-featured advanced wallet that's easy to use, available on every platform. We have great language support. We have best customer service in the business. So if you have an issue with just how do I do this, we're on top of it and help you through that process.
So that's pretty good for a free product.
Yeah, given that we're not charging people anything, I think it's a pretty good deal. So we're seeing just a ton of growth globally in all kinds of places, like, you know, Russia and India and some of these countries where you're seeing more financial turmoil, like Argentina and Brazil. And if you look at the exchange rate of ruble Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin, I think, is already at an all-time high relative to the ruble and has been doing really strongly there for a while. So sometimes I forget that on the ground experience in a different country and the value of Bitcoin can be very different than it is, you know, to a Westerner, someone in Europe or the US. The value of the ruble has been eroding pretty dramatically. And so that changes the value proposition relative to Bitcoin, even when Bitcoin is just stable at 400 or 350 or whatever. When your currency is crumbling, you get more excited about being able to tap into an alternative.
Do you want to talk any more about your belief system? Or
yeah, sure. I think Bitcoin to me feels like a really interesting technology because it is a freedom enhancing technology. It's a digital technology as we transition to a digital age. And so it feels like we're making these decisions about how we're going to live digitally. And by getting Bitcoin and things like Bitcoin adopted and accepted at this early stage, then we, I think, benefit ourselves down the road. It gives you a way to opt out of current systems that wasn't really there before. It's like you could be interested in not supporting the American government and war and all kinds of different things or whatever your pet interest is, but there wasn't a practical way to really opt out. Sure, you could hold your investments in gold, but it wasn't something that you could easily transact with. And I think Bitcoin opens the door to being able to do that. And you see some people really on the far end of the spectrum and living most of their life on Bitcoin and using just that. But even if, you know, you're using it for 10 or 20%, I think it shows that there's this pathway that can happen where you don't have to do super extreme things, and maybe in, you know, 3 to 5 years, you can be primarily Bitcoin based and be living in the US. And I think that is a pretty cool thing. And it's part of the vision that the cypherpunks laid out 20 years ago now or more about what this digital internet world was going to look like and what they were trying to create. And people like Adam Back and Nick Szabo and a lot of these guys who are into Bitcoin were around then and talking about smart contracts then. And Adam obviously invented some of the cool stuff, Hashcash, that drives Bitcoin. And I think that we're still very much in the process of deciding what we want to do in a digital world and what we want that society to look like. And you know, some of these things are really fundamental decisions about what kind of rights we have. And Bitcoin is a way to tap into important rights. And it's also a mechanism for thinking about how we can do things differently and the value of doing things differently. And so for both of those reasons, I think it's a really critical technology, and it's the main reason I got excited about it and wanted to spend more time working on it.
So I always give everyone who comes on the show a Bitcoin keychain. I don't know if you have one of these yet.
Not yet.
All right.
Excellent. I love it. Thank you.
Well, there you go. You got paid a keychain for your 3 hours here.
Thanks, Rob. I really appreciate you having me. Bitcoin.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing my interview with Christopher Camp. And unlike Patrick Milton, Paul Boyer, Mark Jeffrey, or Ed Neathan, I have yet to hang up my Bitcoin podcasting hat. I'm The BTC Game on Twitter, and you can scan through my past episodes at thebitcoingame.com. See you next time. So you want your Bitcoin?
Uh-huh.
What happened to your Bitcoin?
I don't even know where it went.